Thank you. Go ahead, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Good afternoon. We're happy to have everybody here for House Judiciary. Anybody who, we bake cookies for anybody in back who'd like to have some cookies, have a cookie. In attendance are Representative Holmes, Representative Samuels, myself, Chair Ramers, Representative Coghill, Representative Lynn. Representative Grunberg is yet to be with us, but he's doing well. He's good, right? And Representative Dahlstrom will be here shortly. I thought it would be appropriate, since we're meeting on Martin Luther King Day, to read a couple of, to start our meeting by reading a couple of excerpts from Dr. King's life. I thought it would be an appropriate tribute to such an important person in American history in the 20th century. So I grabbed a couple of quotes. I didn't want to just do quips, so I actually got a couple of paragraphs that Emily, from our staff research force, from Martin Luther King's Nobel Peace Prize acceptance speech. So with your indulgence, I thought I'd read that, and then a couple of quotes which will help us deal kind of with some of the issues we're going to take on today and frame those for us. So this was part of his Peace Prize acceptance speech. He went on to say, "I believe that unarmed truth and unconditional love will have the final word in reality. This is why right, temporarily defeated, is stronger than evil triumphant. I believe that wounded justice, lying prostrate on the blood-flowing streets of our nations, can be lifted from this dust of shame to reign supreme among the children of men. I believe that what self-centered men have torn down, men other-centered can build up. This faith can give us courage to face the uncertainties of the future. It will give our tired feet new strength as we continue our forward stride toward the city of freedom. When our days become dreary with low hovering clouds and our nights become darker than a thousand midnights, we will know that we are living in the creative turmoil of a genuine civilization struggling to be born." She's deep. And then a couple of quotes from Dr. King. "Faith is taking the first step, even when you don't see the whole staircase. Hatred paralyzes life. Love releases it. Hatred confuses life. Love harmonizes it. Hatred darkens life. Love illuminates it." Speaking of love, Representative Dahlstrom, it's so nice to see you.
Thank you.
"I believe that unarmed truth and unconditional love will have the final word in reality. That is why right, temporarily defeated, is stronger than evil triumphant. In the end, we will remember not the words of our enemies, but the silence of our friends. It may be true that the law cannot make a man love me, but it can stop him from lynching me, and I think that's pretty important." And then finally, "Our scientific power has outrun our spiritual power. We have guided missiles and misguided men." And then the last one that I selected, "The ultimate measure of a man or woman is not where he stands in moments of comfort and convenience, but where he stands at times of challenge and controversy." Pretty great guy. With us today are Representative Keller, Representative Johnson, Representative Dahl, and our committee. We're going to take up two bills today. First is House Bill 255 with Representative Johnson, and then House Bill 301. And Representative Johnson, nice to see you. And Representative Dahlstrom, would you adopt the CS
for
us? We have a working document.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would move the CS for House Bill number 55-25-LS0914/E.
Second.
Thank you. We have the CS for House Bill 255 before us. Representative Johnston, I see you. Jeannie, if you'd introduce yourself for the record, we'd appreciate it.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is, for the record, Craig Johnston, Representative District 28.
And my name is Jeannie Osnes. I am staff to Craig Johnston.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We heard this bill at the end of session last year, so it kind of feels like I've never left. But in essence, what HB 255 does is it provides an opportunity for a dual sentence, and that's a juvenile who commits a certain class of crime, instead of an option of waiving directly into adult prison, that they be given a chance to serve a juvenile term. If for some reason they do not fill the requirements of that juvenile term, they can be remanded to adult court. This keeps people from, basically, if you get out of juvenile detention, the next way we have an opportunity to catch someone who is not an upstanding citizen is when they commit another crime. This is an opportunity. This bill also provides for that individual who may be 20, who has gone, or 19 or 20, and has gone through all the steps and basically taken the test, got their GED, and basically gamed the system, who may have not been rehabilitated, that the department feels that maybe they need a little more supervision. Instead of just turning them loose, it allows for them to be placed under adult probation so that we can keep an eye on those individuals for additional years. Over the summer, we held five meetings with the task force in Anchorage, chaired by the police chief, Hume, and we dealt with this, and I will tell you that they could not come up with a consensus of agreement. There were members of the committee who thought this was one of the best things they could do, and there were other members of the committee who thought that this was a little bit extreme. I think what people are getting wrapped around the axle about is the age. You take a very young person and you give an opportunity for them to have an adult sentence. But I think what this does is give a young person an opportunity to serve adult time. If you commit a crime that is potential discretionary waiver, it would give the judge the opportunity to say, you will go to juvenile, you will get a chance to be rehabilitated, but if you don't take a step in the right direction to become a productive citizen, that you can, in fact, have an adult sentence imposed upon you at that time. As seems like most bills that I bring before this committee, it is not simple. This bill started out for me as a mandatory waiver for certain crimes, that if you do a certain crime, regardless of your age, you will go to jail. The administration came to me and said they didn't particularly care for that. I don't know that I particularly cared about having young people in adult prisons. This was an option to give every opportunity for that citizen under the age of 19 or 20 to rehabilitate. It gives the judge another tool. It also is a hammer over the head of that juvenile who's in the juvenile detention that can't game the system because they know at the end, the light at the end of the tunnel may be jail bar slamming on them. So it gives them incentive to become productive citizen. It gives the department an opportunity to rehabilitate those that can be rehabilitated, and for those that can't, it doesn't require them to reoffend before we can put them back into prison. This is a public safety issue. So many of our crimes these days are being committed by juveniles in gang-related instances. So if we can get our hands on these young people and work them through the system, great. For those that we can't, it's an opportunity for us to protect the public into the future. I'm sure there'll be a lot of testimony on this bill, and I do beg the committee's indulgence. I do have a 1:30 meeting with the other bodies counterpart on another piece of legislation, but I will be leaving it in the capable hands of staff, who probably knows more about it than I do. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Questions for the bill sponsor? Yes. Representative Sanders.
Thank you. The way I'm reading this, Representative Johnston, the district attorney could decide. So if you had a 15-year-old who is not automatically waived into adult court, the district attorney could still decide there might be an instance where you wanted to waive them at adult court and you do not want dual sentencing. You want to throw the book at them.
I still can.
Through the chair.
Up to the district attorney, not to the defense.
Right. Mr. Chairman, this does not take away any of the ability of the district attorney to seek discretionary waiver for those crimes that are deemed heinous. For example, there was, you know, a 12-year-old in Florida just beat their cousin to death. Should that person be in a juvenile facility? That's a decision that I'm not going to make or shouldn't be making. A judge should make. And if it's deemed that this person could be there, this would not keep the discretionary waiver from happening in any form or fashion. This is just another tool in the toolbox for that judge.
For the district attorney?
For the district attorney, yes.
They can still choose to go through the waiver proceeding for a 15-year-old that committed a violent offense. The district attorney could still say, we're not going to go with dual sentencing on this one. This is for whatever reason, but it's up to their discretion.
Through the chair, Representative Simmons, that is correct.
And I guess probably more questions for the department. What would be the appellate process for that?
Through the chair, you're absolutely right. It would be a better question for the department.
Other questions for the bill sponsor?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm looking on page 3 of the bill. It's section 4. And there's obviously some conforming language in here, but there's down towards the bottom on lines 19 to 20, there's a change in the standard, the burden of proof. And I'm just a little confused on this section. It looks like if a petition is filed, if the minor commits a subsequent felony or a subsequent offense, then the court has to find by a preponderance of the evidence another crime has been committed. So I guess I got two questions. First is that the only finding of guilt, or does the minor go through a trial, and if they're convicted, then the court has to find by preponderance of the evidence they've committed another, or is that the only finding of guilt for the second offense?
Through the chair, Representative Holmes, if the district attorney chose to prosecute that second offense, that offense would be there, but also I think the adult sentence that was part of the dual sentencing could also be imposed. So I think they would have to be found guilty of the second offense.
Okay.
They could also be incarcerated immediately, is my understanding, as a result of violating to serve the second part of their adult sentence. So there wouldn't be that necessarily that time where we have a problem individual on the street that they, I think, could be incarcerated on the second part of the dual sentencing or the adult portion of the dual sentencing. So that could be, they could be taken directly into that and then tried for their second, third, fourth offense. Hopefully it never gets there, but okay. It's an opportunity. And that's part of the purpose of this bill is to keep those people who have a propensity to reoffend. It keeps them from having to make that second offense before they are remanded to custody in violation of the second part of the dual sentencing.
I guess I'm just trying to get my head around the idea that they could be reincarcerated on only a preponderance of the evidence. For those people who don't know, it's basically 50% plus a hair. So it's basically, I think, probably more likely than not, but it's a pretty low burden. So, and I know this part of the burden is in the existing law. It's not something you're trying to change. But then later on, there's a changing where the burden to put them in is only a preponderance of the evidence, but the burden for them to come up with mitigating circumstances is actually raised to a higher burden. So I'm just trying to get my head around what it's going to take to throw them back in and reimpose the sentence. It seems like it's a pretty low threshold to impose the adult sentence. Normally in criminal cases, to be found guilty on that second offense, as you pointed out, would take clear and convincing, which is a very high standard. You'd be pretty darn sure. But to throw them back into jail with the adult sentence on the first one would only take sort of I think maybe they probably committed the offense. So I'm just trying to get my head around how this works and with the burdens.
Through the chair, and this is probably my right-leaning philosophy is going to come to bear here, but I certainly hope so, that it shouldn't be as difficult, that if we have someone who's endangering the public, and there is a situation where they may be arrested, et cetera, I would certainly wish for a lower threshold, because public safety is the overriding cause. I do not want to violate anyone's rights, but I also I would like to tip the scales a little bit towards the public and my constituents and your constituents than to someone who has already been convicted of a crime. And once, if they're exonerated from that second crime, I certainly think that adult sentence would be at the discretion of the judge to remove. But I'm certainly going to lean a little more towards protecting the public. And this committee has the charge of deciding where they want to land.
Good.
More? One more follow-up, if I may. As I noted, that part was in existing law, but then in the later part, this bill would raise the burden on, and I'm on lines 19 and 20 now on page 3, would raise the burden to show that there were any kind of mitigating circumstances. Can you just address why that change is in there, what that's addressing?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Holmes, I would like to defer that to either some of the brighter legal minds, either on the committee, but certainly I do not even want to be in, you know, associated with that. We have Jerry Luckup online who can address,
or Luckup right there,
maybe not online, who might be able
lurking
to address that.
Door.
And certainly, okay. I would expect this committee to flush that type of thing out.
Representative Samuel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So you have an example. You're a 15-year-old kid. You commit a murder. The district attorney decides to go with a dual sentencing format. At what age do you get booted out of McLaughlin? You're at McLaughlin, let's say. You do this in Anchorage. You're in McLaughlin until you are at 19 or 20?
Can be. Through the chair.
Through the chair, Representative Samuels, that is correct, but that doesn't mean that you have to wait till you're 19 and 20. If you've got a 15-year-old that is victimizing other inmates, that is a problem person.
I say they're not a problem person, though. They go through this and
yes, sir.
Who determines whether the treatment sticks or not?
Through the chair, that is an administrative decision by the juvenile justice.
Okay.
And that, I want to qualify that by turning and asking.
I think that's correct. Is that where this is? You're not paying attention to
this. Yes, I am. The juvenile would. Who makes the determination whether or not the juvenile is?
You want him up here, Mr. Chairman?
Yeah, we he's okay. Certainly. And with that, with to beg the committee's indulgence, I would like to step out and go to another committee, but I would be happy to stay here if it would be the will
up
of this committee.
Yeah, the stir and run tactic isn't going to.
It seems to work for me sometimes.
Oh, well, not today.
Yeah,
not today. So, I am happy to hear that, but I need to. It strikes me it's similar to your depiction of these committee meetings that it's cumbersome to build a consensus around this. So I think we're going to we're delighted to have you come back and talk about this a little bit more. I think, and so we'll let you.
Chairman, thank you. We certainly have experts who deal with this on a day-to-day basis that I think can answer those questions.
Yeah, and we will continue to take a little more testimony today, and then we're going to move on. But I need to get comfortable with this myself because it's it's an interesting approach to a public safety issue. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Are there questions for Jeannie, or would you like to hear from Tony Newman is here with the Juvenile Justice, and then we have available Mr. Luckup is here, Quinlan Steiner is available, Josh Fink with OPA is here, Quinlan, Mr. Steiner is with Public Defenders, and then Dwayne Peoples is here also from Department of Corrections. Is there direction that the committee would like to go in? Are there any questions for any of those folks or for Jeannie?
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to hear from Juvenile Justice and Annie Carpinetti also.
Mm-hmm.
I just want to know how it flows. In my example, which I didn't finish, you had a 15-year-old who commits a murder. The 15-year-old goes into the dual system. Who chooses whether they get out or not? Once they get out, if they do not get the probation and then something else happens to them, is this record sealed or is this record not sealed? The scenario for my Winona Fletcher example, I will call it.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman. My name is Tony Newman. I'm a program officer with the Division of Juvenile Justice in the Department of Health and Social Services. And I'll just jump ahead to Representative Samuel's question. If a juvenile succeeds in the juvenile system, he would go back to court, and the court would determine that his order is over and that he's finished. Now, under a dual sentence, that same process would apply, except the juvenile will have this imposed unless the court decides he's not going to get the adult sentence. The juvenile can make a request to the court to have the adult sentence that was previously pronounced not imposed, and he can do that if the department agrees that that adult sentence can be dismissed. If the department feels that the juvenile has not succeeded in the juvenile system, then we make a petition to the court to have the adult system imposed. So that's the way it's supposed to work under both scenarios, success and not success.
If I could, Mr. Chairman, the criteria then, so you've got, you know, the department determining whether or not this person is successful or not successful within your programs, you know, where's the blame going to lie when the next guy gets murdered? I mean, is somebody going to be accountable for the decision for letting this person go? Right now, if you let somebody go, you're going to blame the judge for not a sentence being imposed, or the jury, or somebody. If you let what I would call the bureaucracy of the juvenile justice system go, and generally speaking, I'm not trying to be confrontational. I agree with an interesting concept, but who's going to decide whether or not this program worked or did not work? I mean, you have to get a GED, and you have to be nice to your fellow inmates, and what all is incorporated in there?
Right. Through the chair. The Division of Juvenile Justice has to make those determinations every day now on whether a juvenile has succeeded and can be released to the safety of the public. Under this approach, the determination of whether or not the youth has succeeded, our treatment facilities, McLaughlin Youth Center, Fairbanks Youth Facility, already have standards of what constitutes treatment. I can read those to you. Those are that the juvenile they have to consider the likelihood of living a crime-free lifestyle, what's in the best interests of society and the resident, and the likelihood that any further progress will be served by remaining in the program. So in addition to those, every juvenile has an individualized treatment plan that will determine that contains goals on whether that they're expected to achieve while they're in the facility, or if they're on probation, they have their probation conditions in their case plan goals. Youth who don't meet those goals but who must be released because their juvenile jurisdiction is about to end are noted in their discharge summaries as having failed their goals. If staff believe that a youth is surface compliant only, that is, they've gotten with the program, but staff aren't sure they've really internalized the change process, we note that on the discharge plan. The court is informed of that we have concerns about that juvenile's release. But currently, under a juvenile order, they turn 19 or 20, they're gone. This gives us an opportunity to provide some sort of sanction that will continue into adulthood past the juvenile age of 19 or 20.
Okay, and if the person then is released, the department determines that it did take, and then they are released.
The treatment did take?
Yes, it worked. Treatment worked. They're amenable to treatment. Treatment took. They're released back into society. Are all those records sealed then completely? You might have a period of adult probation. I understand that. So you, 3 or 4 years, but after that, it's sealed as if they were a juvenile and there was no dual sentencing. They're just sealed, and you cannot look at them even during sentencing for a further felony conviction.
Through the chair, if I understood the question, is a young person who is dual sentenced is successfully completes their juvenile order and does not have the adult sentence imposed. What happens to their records? Right now, I believe that the law says that the court records are open, because you can't say that an adult conviction didn't happen. So that they are available right now as adult records. currently. They're not sealed, and I'm going to look to Annie and ask that question. I believe that's true.
Juvenile records are available to probation officers to for pre-sentence reports.
Annie, would you come up and join us just so we have you on the record, please?
Six people.
So, Mr. Chairman, if I could just clarify that. Right the way it is currently, if a juvenile commits a crime and they're off to McLaughlin or Fairbanks Youth Center or wherever, they commit a crime, they're at McLaughlin, they're released on their 19th birthday or whenever their sentence is up, that is public information, or not public information, that is available to a judge at a sentence. So I commit a crime when I'm 17, I go spend 2 years at McLaughlin, and at 20 I commit the same crime or a felony of some other kind. They can look back and they say, this is a pattern, and I can up the sentence in the range.
Through the chair, that is true for felonies. When a juvenile is adjudicated on a felony, a judge, in determining mitigating and aggravating factors, can use a previous felony adjudication to help determine those aggravators or mitigators. So they can look back and see what the record holds.
Okay. And then on a third offense, so we have a three strikes and you're outlaw in Alaska?
Through the chair, yes.
And would this count as one?
Through the chair, no, I don't believe a juvenile adjudication would count as a conviction for three strikes and you're out. But I would appreciate an opportunity to go back and check that. But it's my understanding that our three strikes and you're out law is very limited as to what counts as a strike.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Thank you. I have a quick question. Representative Hall. So what's the potential for unintended consequence with this bill? I mean, perhaps I don't understand the subject matter well enough, but would the ability, if it's a Class B felony, is there any likelihood that without dual sentencing that a potentially dangerous minor would be treated as an adult, and that with the opportunity for dual sentencing that a judge that might have a more lenient perspective would offer to treat the minor as a minor with the expectation of being able to put adult probation on the person, but in essence, at that critical path, at that moment where a judge decides this is a juvenile that should be treated like an adult, or a juvenile that should be treated like a juvenile with the augmentation of adult probation following their juvenile period, are we running a risk of lenient judge taking the opportunity to provide an offender of a Class B felony a second chance, whereas if dual sentencing weren't on the books, perhaps they would have a brighter line to draw between a minor, treating him like a minor, and adult? Maybe I don't understand the subject matter well enough, but that's my question, I think.
Through the chair, I hope I understand. I'll try and answer that question, and if I miss parts of it, just let me remind me.
Or if my question misses the bill, just be straight.
Right now, there is a procedure that is called discretionary waiver, and the state can request the court to waive a juvenile who is under 18 or under 15, if it's a very serious crime that would otherwise be subject to automatic waiver, to consider the discretionary waiver of a juvenile into adult court. Such as Winona Fletcher was waived.
Yes, she was waived.
Yes. Discretionarily, not automatically.
Yes.
Right now, our dual sentencing statute only applies to one Class B felony against a person, which is second-degree sexual abuse of a minor. So, right under our current law, only that Class B felony is subject to eligibility for dual sentencing. This bill expands that eligibility to all Class B felonies against a person for a court to And this is a series of steps that you get to before you get to a dual sentencing provision. You have the department making a decision. You have the district attorney making it. You have the district attorney making a decision whether or not to request that dual sentencing be applied to the person.
Mr. Yes. Sheriff, I may. It's correct, except with the aspect it can be any felony against a person is currently eligible for dual sentencing as long as there's a previous adjudication.
That's correct.
Or conviction for a felony against a person.
I stand a B felony for the first.
So my question, I certainly see the element of safety for the public to be able to put a tail on a minor that graduates out of the juvenile system. And so my concern is looking at it through the other direction of the looking glass. What potential risk does dual sentencing create for the public? So if they had five task force meetings and there was no consensus, clearly there's a way to look back the other way that causes a problem. So that's my concern, is not the obvious good that dual sentencing provides. My concern is what is wrong with dual sentencing.
Sure. Mr. Chim, can you hear me?
Sure. Susan, can you hear? Okay.
Yes, sir.
As Ms. Carpinetti said, right now, for a juvenile, say 15 years of age, who commits a murder, we've got basically two processes. We've either got this discretionary waiver process, which doesn't happen very often. It's difficult. We have had youth that we have forwarded for a discretionary waiver process through our district attorneys, and it happens very rarely. Most of the time, it's just too difficult a legal tangle to try and figure out, is this youth amenable to treatment in the juvenile system or not? Often those youth return to us, but sometimes they are waived into the adult system, never given a chance to succeed in the juvenile system. Okay. What's attractive to the department about this bill is it would create a third way, a way for this juvenile to put some time in the juvenile system. He reaches the end of that, and we've still got concerns about him or her, an opportunity to continue some measure of public safety and accountability on that person for a while.
There are two sides to the question. The original bill, I believe, had expanded the auto waiver provisions, which expanded the number of crimes that a juvenile would just be sent to the adult justice system without any procedure. Just applies, they send it to adult court. The other side is people, the other side is that the mission of DJJ is to try and rehabilitate youthful offenders because these people are young and going to be out, and the public safety would really mitigate in favor of trying to work with them at an early age rather than send them to adult prison and where your chances are not quite nearly as good of being rehabilitated.
But Annie, is there anything wrong with this bill? I mean, it's a subjective question, but
we support this bill.
Okay. Very good. Okay. Very good. Representative Holmes and Samuels.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Like you, I'm still trying to get my head around what I think about this bill, and so I appreciate you guys being here to help us sort of muddle through it. Hypothetical, you've got a juvenile commits a crime, let's say manslaughter, because that's one that could be without actual evil intent. How long, let me back up, they go through the program as a juvenile, they get to the point where they're going to age out of the system, and my understanding is one of three things can happen. Either they can say, yep, they did a good job, they're rehabilitated, and we're going to wipe everything, they're going to go forward with no probation or anything. They can go forward with probation under the adult system, or they can actually have the adult sentence imposed. Am I correct on that? Okay, so say we go with option two. They think they're making progress. They're not really sure. They want to keep an eye on them for a while, so they choose to go with the probation route. I'm trying to get my head around how long that probationary period is going to be. How far into adulthood is this going to be with them? And I understand clearly if another serious crime is committed, then you've got it. Existing sentence that can be reimposed as well as a new sentence. How about if it's a DUI? You know, it's how far down there? Do they have to be, I mean, if they commit something that's, say, a far less serious offense, what happens? How does this work out? Do they get a manslaughter sentence imposed on them years later? Or do you understand where I'm kind of going with this?
I think Mr. Newman can.
Well, let's just go through, I guess. We have, in your example, a 15-year-old commits a manslaughter. Mm-hmm. He is referred for dual sentencing, so he receives both an adult sentence mm-hmm. and a juvenile order. He puts, juvenile orders are 2 years long. He puts in 2 years. He's 17 years of age. We extend the order because we're still not sure about his public safety concern. So he stays in the juvenile system another year or two. With the juvenile's agreement, he can stay in the juvenile system up to age 20. Okay. So he reaches age 20, and he has succeeded, in your example, in the juvenile system, you're thinking?
Yes.
You're thinking he's succeeded. So
there are still some questions, though you have adult probation.
Maybe we have some concerns about his suitability to be released to the public. So we would go back to court at that time. And he has already, because he's already received an adult sentence, that comes with its minimum time frames that the judge has already imposed. And so when it comes time to impose the adult sentence, the judge will have that sentence standing by with all its time frames already spelled out. The judge can make the decision on how much of that, within the constraints of the sentencing laws, how much of that to suspend, how much of it would be served in prison, how much would be served in adult felony probation, or according to the CS of the bill, it could be dismissed.
So, if I may, Mr. Chairman, so when they get to the point where they really are aged out of the juvenile system, maybe they've extended it a little bit, can they go, instead of actually having the sentence imposed, can they be put on adult probation for a while? And if so, how long? Do we know how long they could be on adult probation?
Through the chair, yes, they would be placed on probation, and again, that'll depend on that sentence that was pronounced earlier, the length of that sentence. Now, if they commit, while they're on that adult probation, say they commit another crime, that needs to be dealt with in its own way as a new crime altogether. That's almost entirely out of the juvenile system altogether. What could happen is we have a juvenile who is on probation, juvenile probation, under a dual sentence, and they commit a crime, say a serious crime, say a serious felony assault, we would have to make the call as to whether we first move them to the adult system now under the dual sentence. Second, do we now discretionarily waive them if they're still under the juvenile? If they're still a juvenile, do we seek to discretionarily waive them, which we would need to do anyway? Do we manage them in the juvenile system still? These are all options open to us under this scenario. And that's, again, one of the things that's attractive about the bill to the department is it creates more tools in the tool shed. One of the representatives of one of the Anchorage task force had said, it sounds like we've got a tool, dual sentencing, that's not being used very much, and this gives us an opportunity to use it more. I had testimony prepared where I could talk about. This is the existing dual sentencing law has only been used, to our knowledge, 5 times in the 10 years since it's been on the books.
If I may, one more follow-up. So it's not an automatic, is what you're saying. If they're on probation and there's some minor, because I think in here it says that, you know, one of the things is violating a condition of probation is something that could kick in, make the adult sentence kick in. If it's if there's a minor violation of probation, that doesn't necessarily mandate automatically that the adult sentence gets kicked in. It's just, it gives discretion for it to be kicked in, but there's some discretion in there. It's not an automatic. Is that correct?
Through the chair, that is correct.
Okay. Thank you. Mm-hmm.
Samuels, Cockhill.
Go ahead.
Jim Cockhill.
So I'm going to go all the way back to the beginning where the options would be on the table. You have charges and possible sentences. And what we've heard in adult serious crimes is there is a bargaining process, sometimes based on the probability of getting a sentence, sometimes based on the cost of getting evidence. And so a juvenile has a different setup than an adult. And so when you get into dual sentencing, what is, help me think through the process that gets to a sentence, because once that sentence happens, it sounds to me like that it could be held in abeyance until 3 years down the road, 4 years down the road, to be held if there's no progress made. And does the bargaining process then begin anew? So help me understand that context. Somebody, please.
No, go ahead.
Oh, through the chair, let me make sure I understood the question. What is the process by which the juvenile's adult sanction would be imposed?
Let me go back to the beginning. I'll start with probably the thing that I need to understand first. If it's anticipated that you'll have dual sentencing, you'll have an adult and a juvenile sentence, it's my understanding the prosecution of those as two different styles, one juvenile, one adult, on bargaining, plea bargaining. Help me understand how that would work, and especially if you do have an adult sentence passed on, how does that look from a prosecutor's perspective, I suppose?
I'll give that one a shot through the chair. I assume that plea negotiations would proceed in a potential dual sentence case, and Mr. Steiner and Mr. Fink can correct me if I'm mistaken, but this would be a tool for the defense also to say, you know, this is a serious crime. Maybe it would be better to, rather than proceeding with a discretionary waiver or requesting discretionary waiver, you could talk about whether or not a dual sentence would be appropriate under the circumstances. And that I think that would be definitely subject to discussions and negotiations with defense counsel and DJJ and the prosecution. Once the dual sentence is imposed, the sentence is imposed. The court has chosen what adult sentence would be appropriate under the circumstances, and I don't believe there would be further negotiations afterwards if there was a petition to impose the adult sentence on what that particular sentence would be.
Sure. And my question came down to, if we have somebody who is amenable to some kind of treatment and a sentence has been imposed, how can you presuppose some of those things when you're looking 3 or 4 years down the road? And what? So I was just in my mind trying to get an idea of how we would look at pre-sentencing and defense or prosecution. Because in one case, under adult criminal proceedings, that's not taken into consideration, where in this particular case it would. And I just, so once again, with the rest of the crew here, I'm trying to figure out, how does this thing work? So just that's a thought process I'm going to have to get settled in my mind as we go down through this bill.
Can we glean an insight from Mr. Steiner and Josh Fink? Are you, gentlemen, are you online?
Sure they are.
Give us just a moment, please.
Mr. Chairman, this is Quinlan Steiner with the Public Defender Agency.
Hi, Quinlan. Nice to hear you. Thanks for coming down last week. Have you been listening to the discussion this afternoon?
I have been.
Would you give us your cursory thoughts, and then Representative Holmes may have questions for you?
Cursory thoughts on the bill as a whole, or an answer to one of the questions specifically? I mean, if you're speaking as the bill as a whole, I did have a chance to work with the gang task force on the bill and was privy to some of the discussions that came up with regard to the bill. And there were sort of three main areas that the committee discussed and didn't reach a consensus on, but they were issues that I thought merited discussion. One was the age which the bill covers. It goes down to 12 years of age. And that generally was a discussion about whether or not 12-year-olds should be subject to an adult sentence, whether or not there was some research that supported their brain chemistry and brain development, you know, not supporting that particular decision at such a young age. The other issue that came up was the burden of proof after a violation. With waiver or discretionary waiver, the burden to show an ability to be rehabilitated is a preponderance standard. In this bill, it changes that to clear and convincing when a probation violation has been established. And then broadly speaking was, you know, dual sentencing versus automatic waiver, which was the preferable means for achieving the goals. And those were the kinds of issues that were discussed.
And Quinlan, what was the conclusion that the Public Defender's Office reached? Are you in support of this legislation? Is before us with the CS, or do you still have reservations?
Well, generally speaking, I don't have a position on the bill. I can just really speak to what I think, you know, some of the consequences are going to be. Okay. You know, and one of the unintended consequences of this bill that you were discussing might be the burden shifting to clear and convincing. You know, there's a very broad definition of what constitutes a probation violation that could result in the imposition of an adult sentence with a very low burden of proof, preponderance. That would shift the burden to the minor to prove by clear and convincing that adult sentence should not be imposed. That kind of shifts the burden of error to the juvenile, so the mistakes that occur, you know, would accrue to the juvenile and result in an adult sentence. And that was one burden shifting aspect that was a concern, because that's not even present in discretionary waiver. And with regard to whether or not it should apply to a 12-year-old, you know, I think there was some research that supported that, but I don't think anyone agreed one way or the other as to whether or not that was applicable. But
okay. Briefly, any questions for Mr. Steiner? It's okay if you don't.
I was just interested in hearing. I think I just pointed out the areas in which he has potential concerns, so it's useful.
Thank you. Mr. Josh, are you with us? Josh Fink?
Mr. Chairman, I am with you. OPA also sent a representative to the task force, and it was my deputy director and the head of my juvenile delinquency unit. And so I think Quinlan summarized what they informed me of. You know, I guess I'm not as well versed in it as Quinlan is to give you OPA's position. We have some concerns, and Mr. Steiner indicated what those were. The brain science seems to be indicating that 12-year-olds, 13-year-olds should not be held to the same level of culpability as an adult. You know, we have the U.S. Supreme Court decision in Roper where they discussed that, and there's been quite a bit of development there. So I think there was some concern about taking this down to the age 12 years old. And then the other concern was this burden shifting, putting much more on the juvenile for any probation violation. It wouldn't be hard to prove by preponderance, for instance, that an 18-year-old didn't go to school, and a condition of probation could be attend classes. Well, that wouldn't be very difficult to prove by preponderance. And then the juvenile's got the burden of showing by clear and convincing that, in fact, you know, they shouldn't have the adult sentence imposed. And so we could see more youthful individuals receiving adult sentences than under current law. And, you know, that's a policy call. But we have some concerns. Mr. Provost, who is the head of my juvenile delinquency unit, is out of state on a family emergency. He'll be back tomorrow, and I'll ask him to prepare some comments or a letter to the committee, and I can more clearly delineate some of the concerns we have.
Okay. Annie Carbonetti?
I would just like to address the changing of the burden in Section 4 of the bill. It's clear that it does change the burden, but it's not an unintended consequence. It's intended. And the reason is, at this point, the juvenile has been sentenced to a juvenile sentence and been given both a dual sentence, an adult and a juvenile sentence. The DJJ does not petition for imposition of these consequences lightly. It's in their discretion to do this, and they don't do it because a child has been truant from school. You know, their whole mission is getting a child into a position where he or she can come back to society and to be a productive member of society. So it gives them the discretion, and when they do decide to petition and it is found that they have violated their conditions, the juvenile is then asking for another chance. And the rationale for clear and convincing standard is to say, you know, you've had a couple chances, and now you really need to convince us that you can still do well in the juvenile system. That is the rationale for the clear and convincing standard. It's a change from current law. It's intended, but, you know, it's certainly something to talk about. But, you know, they're asking you for another chance. They ought to be able to articulate it clearly.
Okay.
And it's not like it's a beyond a reasonable doubt as a criminal conviction would be. It's just a little bit higher than preponderance.
Tony?
Mr. Chairman, just to reiterate what Annie said, the division does not take this idea of moving a juvenile into the adult system lightly. The reward and the mission of our job is to keep kids out of the adult criminal system. This idea of, sounds like there's concern over the idea of probation violations resulting in a possible adult sentence, this idea that if a kid misses school or is late for a probation appointment, they might be ejected into the adult system. That is certainly not the intention. Right now, there are as far as crimes go, the bill allows that if you commit a felony or a misdemeanor involving injury or a misdemeanor against a person, then you can have the department can move to have the adult sentence imposed. But there are a whole range of crimes that are not misdemeanors against persons and do not involve use of a deadly weapon and are not felonies, but that could represent a public safety concern to us nevertheless. So if a juvenile, for instance, had the dual sentence imposed because they killed someone while drunk, while they're on probation, about to end their juvenile order, they're arrested for drunk driving. Not a felony, not a misdemeanor crime against a person, but cause for concern. Perhaps they were a sex offender, and they're released, and one of their probation conditions is they are not to spend time around small children, and we find them on a playground in a daycare center. Not a crime, but it's a probation violation. So that's what that was about. That said, we would not oppose the bill if the committee was uncomfortable with the idea of probation violations as a cause for moving a youth to the adult system.
How many young people move through the juvenile system annually? A few hundred?
In a year, we're referred about 5,000, between 5,000 and 6,000 juveniles a year.
That actually spend time at McLaughlin or at the youth facility?
No, the great majority of youth who are referred to us are adjusted out without entering a court process. Then of those that do enter a court process, the majority remain on juvenile probation and remain in their homes and in the community. So we're down to, right now at McLaughlin has something on the order of 200 and 250 beds. So right now kids in secure treatment are around the state, around 350, I think.
Yes, you know, we have a 200% turnover at my job, for instance. What's the annual turnover of people in the youth facilities annually? Is it 500 people, 600, 250 beds? Are you turning over those beds twice a year? You know, are there 600 or 700 juveniles that are exposed to, you know, state-sponsored visit to our correctional facilities? Is that a fair number, 600, 700? There's, how many beds are there in Fairbanks? 50 beds?
I believe there's 30 or maybe 40. I don't have the exact number.
So about 300 juvenile beds in the state.
Right.
They turned over twice. That would be 600 kids a year that are exposed to incarceration in a juvenile system. And so a fraction of those kids, because you'd have to be incarcerated in order to be subject to the dual sentencing, not necessarily. Is it a broader universe of people that would potentially be exposed to the dual sentencing?
If you have committed one of these offenses, then you can. If you've been alleged to commit one of these offenses, you would be eligible for dual sentencing. You could be on probation. You could wind up on probation in a residential program or in a juvenile facility.
Representative Samuel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. A question for both of you, I guess. You'd characterize the worst case scenario would be somebody that would have been waived and they get into this system, they get out, they reoffend, and somebody else gets hurt. And the best case scenario is somebody that would have been waived, they get into this system, but then they contribute to society, they never reoffend again. So those are if you cut down to the worst case and the best case scenarios, that's your policy choice. So how many, if that's true, how many waiving proceedings, not the auto waiver, but the discretionary waiver proceedings have taken place since auto waiver was enacted in 94? Does this happen every year, every other year, 10 times a year? It can't
through
be
the chair. Yeah, I tried to participate the question, anticipate the question, Representative Samuels. And since our new database went into effect in 2002, I was able to find record of 9 juveniles who were discretionarily waived. So it doesn't happen very often. We know that for sure. We've had more youth than that were forwarded and referred for discretionary waiver, but most of those came back. We believe we don't. I'm not quite sure how many we recommended for discretionary waiver that were returned to us. But I know that we had about 9 cases that were referred for discretionary waiver, and that went through.
Okay, thank you.
Any other questions? Is there anybody here from the public that wants to weigh in on this bill? Anybody online? I don't think we have anybody online. All right, I'm going to close public testimony on this. I get it, and I generally like it, but we would like to see a little more material, and I think Mr. Fink said he would prepare a letter for us if we can pick that up and just have a little bit of time to kind of comb over the nature of this. But thank you very much for your testimony. Are there any final questions for anybody on the committee?
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Cargill.
I just saw in my packet a couple of amendments that were going to be brought forward. It might be interesting.
They're in the CS.
Okay. I'm sorry. It was in the CS that we adopted. Thank you. I'm sorry.
Representative Holmes?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just one last. The department is in favor of this bill, or does the department taken a stand on this?
Through the chair, we're supportive of this bill.
Thought so, but just wanted to be clear. Okay, thank you. Sounded like
okay, thank you very much.
I just wanted to be sure.
Okay, with that, we're going to move to House Bill 301. Representative Keller, it's nice to see you. Jim Pound, right on, man. Always good to see you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
All right, and would you just tell us what the structure presentation is? Is Representative Coghill going to participate in this? Or are you going to take us through this? Do you have anybody who's going to testify? We have Karen Lewis with Alaska Right to Life who's here. I don't know who else. If you could just frame the nature of the testimony for us, I'd appreciate it.
thank you. For the record, Wes Keller, District 14. what I'd respectfully ask is if you'd let me make a few brief statements about the bill, and then let the prime co-sponsors also make a statement. That's Representative Coghill and Representative Lynn. And then Jim Pound has done a masterful job of putting the packet together and helping with the bill, and I'd like him to be able to make a statement. And as far as testimony, the nature of the testimony, I'm not sure who's called in, but if you say Karen is online, that's great.
And we have Sid, Alaskans for Life, John Monagle, and Debbie, our friend Debbie Jocelyn is here from out Delton, North Pole way. Nice to see you. Okay. Representative Keller, it's so nice to see you. By the way, welcome. We're so happy to have you here in this capacity. You're looking good.
Here.
Go ahead.
Proceed. House Bill 301 will add Alaska to the list of 36 states that have restrictions in place for a medical procedure that even the members of Congress have called inhumane and brutal. As the name implies, it will stop a practice that allows a child to be partially born and then killed. Congress passed legislation against this procedure in 1995. It was subsequently vetoed. And then again in 2003, Congress passed a version that had broad bipartisan support. In fact, it passed 281 to 142 in the House and the Senate 64 to 33. The bill before you today is tailored to meet the intent of that federal law, and it continues to provide for the protection of the life of the mother. It definitely it defines the procedure, partial birth abortion procedure, specifically using the language in the federal law. So that's all the statements I was going to make. I just keep it real brief, and I would ask that you allow Representative Coghill and Representative Lynn and Jim Pond to proceed.
Thank you, Representative Coghill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The language that he's talking about went to the Supreme Court. So when it did that, my thought came immediately to our own statute, which has been kept from being enforced in Alaska. So this helps us meet the congressional court standard and would then really put it forward again in our law. It was certainly, I think it would be challenged. There's no doubt in my mind it would be challenged. But I still think it's a good public policy. So without getting in, so that's kind of the legal framework to it. So Mr. Chairman, I'd probably prefer if we go ahead and go along through public testimony, and then we can go ahead. And I know there's at least one amendment, and that will probably drive us right down into the substance of the bill.
Okay. Are there questions for Representative Keller? We're okay to kind of peel this onion back. All right. Is Karen Lewis with us? Are you online, Karen?
Yes, I am. Thank you, Chairman Ramirez, and sponsors of this bill, Representatives Keller, Coghill, Lynn, Wilson, Gatto, and Nancy Dahlstrom, and other committee members. I'd like to thank you and commend you for hearing this very important piece of legislation. I enjoyed hearing Representative Ramos read excerpts from Dr. Martin Luther King's writings. He was a very eloquent warrior for justice. I don't know if you know this, but his niece, Dr. Albeda King, was the keynote speaker at our annual Proudly Pro-Life dinner this past November at the Captain Cook Hotel. And she told us that Dr. Martin Luther King would have been marching with us and speaking against the injustices that are being inflicted on the unborn children in our nation. She stated that she believes that abortion is the human rights issue of our time, and I believe that also. It's difficult for me to understand why and how this nation continues to allow the brutal and merciless slaughter of our most precious resource, our children. However, if you look back on time, a little over 150 years ago, African Americans were deemed by the Supreme Court as not fully human. I believe it was three-fifths human. And the Native American Indians were systematically slaughtered with tax funds. So I guess it's not much of a surprise to see what's going on now with the killing of our babies. As of tomorrow, Roe v. Wade has been in effect for 35 years, and about 50 million preborn children have been killed at the hands of their mothers and of the hired abortionists. So I appreciate you all bringing this forward as a very good piece of legislation. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Are there questions for Ms. Lewis? Thank you for taking the time to be with us. Here in the room, Sid, are you with us? Thank you. Thanks, gentlemen. Good afternoon. It's so nice to see you.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Sid Heidersdorf. I'm president of Alaskans for Life, which is a Juneau-based right-to-life organization. We support House Bill 301, and as we support all efforts to bring our state statutes in line with abortion restrictions, which are permitted by the courts. We are opposed to partial birth abortion. It's a gruesome, horrifying procedure. However, this is not why we oppose it. We oppose it because it kills a baby. And there is no moral difference, really, between a partial birth abortion and any other abortion. What sets partial birth abortion apart is that it's a procedure which is so horrifying that you would have rights to hope that even abortion supporters would condemn it. Simply reflecting on what it is should be adequate to convince anyone that this is a procedure which should be prohibited. Supporting it really is an effort to defend the indefensible. Partial birth abortion really is virtual infanticide. So we think it shouldn't be a controversial issue, really. Sadly, in many instances, we have been mistaken in not fully appreciating the commitment that some individuals have to abortion, regardless of the circumstances of the pregnancy. This is simply reaping, I believe, the harvest of Roe v. Wade, which legalized abortion at any stage of pregnancy for any reason or for no reason. So we need to have this ban enforced if we want to maintain at least some semblance in our society as a civil society when it comes to how we treat the most defenseless members of the human family. So we thank the sponsors for this proposed legislation, and we ask for favorable consideration by this committee. Thank you very much.
Are there questions? Thank you very much for taking the time to join the committee this afternoon. Is John Monocle here?
Yes.
Hi, John. Thank you for joining us this afternoon, John.
Thank you.
You'll introduce yourself for the record.
King Day. Yeah.
Yes, sir.
Mr. Chairman, members of the board, John Monocle. I'm just here to testify on my own behalf. And there's nobody in this room that can convince me that that fetus means anything other than a human being. That is, in fact, a human being. That is a baby that we're killing. And so any effort that we can do to stop this crime, and it is a crime and worse, that we can do to stop this, then we should make that effort. And for that reason, I support this legislation. Thank you.
Thank you, John. Are there questions for John? Thank you very much,
Thank
Mr.
Monocle.
Our friend Debbie, it's so nice to see you. Take your time. It's nice to see a friendly face from near home, at least.
Sitting in the chairs.
Thank you. If you'll introduce yourself, please, Debbie, for the record.
For the record, my name is Debbie Jocelyn, and I'm president of Eagle Forum Alaska. We're a statewide all-volunteer pro-family group, and I'm from Delta Junction. And I want to thank you, Chairman Ramirez, and the committee for hearing this bill today. Appreciate the prompt hearing of the bill. And thank the sponsors for introducing this bill. It's a good thing. And, you know, it's been mentioned that there was broad bipartisan support for the passing of partial birth abortion ban in Congress. How broad? I do believe that Hillary Clinton voted yes on the ban. That's how broad it was. And it's in part to the publicity that was surrounded what this procedure really is. And it's been mentioned that, you know, there really isn't a pretty way to kill an unborn baby. If we were to sit here and describe in detail every procedure, I don't think you would like any of those any better. But this is particularly gruesome, and it's received a great deal of publicity, brought it to the forefront, and passed our Congress. Signed by the President, the Supreme Court has looked at it, the United States Supreme Court, and has decided that it is constitutional to ban this form of abortion. I urge the committee to pass this bill with no amendments. The bill is just to line us up with the U.S. Constitution. That is a good thing, to support our Constitution. And I think that this is something that our legislature can be very proud of if we pass this bill promptly this year. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there questions for Debbie? And Debbie, thank you for lending your voice to the debate and discussion. Is there anybody else online or in the room that would care to testify on this subject, on HB 301? Do we have anybody else? Okay. We noticed this meeting last week, I think, so it's an ample opportunity. All right. So with that, we're going to close the public testimony, and we'll bring it back to the committee. Do we have just one amendment before us? Is that right? Representative Holmes?
People have copies? Or is it, okay, I didn't have one.
So do all the members have a copy of the amendment before them? We have before us House Bill 301. Representative Holmes, if you would move amendment number one, and I'll object for the purpose of the discussion.
I move amendment number one.
All right, and I object. Representative Holmes?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Amendment number one actually does not amend the language that is in the bill right now. It leaves that intact. It amends another section of the statute. The statute that we're dealing with, the bill in front of us amends Section C, which is a definition section. This would amend Section A. Section A, as written right now, contains an exception for the life of the mother. When the life of the mother is in danger, the amendment would change that to include the life and the health of the mother. And I believe that that is critical language to have, that there be an exception if not only the mother's actual life is in danger. This says that it would also, if there was a substantial risk of permanent injury to the pregnant woman's physical or mental health, there would be an exception to the statute that this could be performed in that case.
What's mental health?
What?
I asked, what is mental health?
That is a good question, Mr. Chairman. The requirement of it being a permanent injury, substantial risk of permanent injury, applies to both the physical and mental health aspects. There are cases in which it could be found that it would cause severe trauma. I don't know the exact medical definition.
Okay. All right. Thank you. I appreciate that. Are there other questions, Representative Cockrell?
Mr. Chairman, I'm going to join you in objecting to the amendment. I like the idea that she put in here permanent injury, but I think if you really think about what's going on here, if a doctor gave a pictorial account of what was actually happening at this abortion, this partial birth abortion, and let the mother see what was happening, that would create permanent mental injury. And I think if we showed those types of things, even in this committee, it would be so hard for us to both handle emotionally and mentally. So to me, that is not a very good reason to soften the effect of this bill, and that's what this would do. You're saying now we have to prove what that is, what is the damage, when in reality what you're doing is you're taking that little life, destroying it at that stage on a supposed mental health problem that could be later on and then would be hard to substantiate. So, because it would have to be permanent. And so when do you say that that's permanent? 40 years from now? So I appreciate what you're saying here is if there, I mentioned this to the sponsor of this amendment earlier. It's a tough world we live in. Sometimes if you come up to an accident where you have four people injured, you have to make a choice. Which one do I save first if they're all look like they could be fatally injured? So that's a tough deal. But that's not where we're at in this particular case. And so to me, the life that is healthy needs to be protected. And if there is mental or physical injury, those things can probably be repaired, but killing a child is irreparable. So I'm going to object to the amendment.
Thank you, Representative Cockhill. And I just want to thank the members in advance for the dignity with which we are showing the subject matter and the members that sit here in the Judiciary Committee, because this is a tinderbox issue, and I just appreciate the etiquette that is shown toward all the members. Representative Lynn?
Thank you for that, Mr. Chair. It seems to me that whatever we do, we need to do our best. The doctor, all of us need to do our best to protect the life of both the mother and the child. And if in that process of trying to protect the child, of trying to protect the other, one is harmed unintentionally, that's an unintended consequence. There's no intent here. So we try to save both as best we can, as best medical science can do that. And again, if it doesn't work out that both can be saved or that both can remain uninjured, again, you know, that's a natural consequence. But we need to, life is precious. The mother's life is precious. The baby's life is precious, as all of our lives are precious. So we need to try to save both. And with that question in mind, how often has this situation occurred? Anybody know the answer to that? And again, and a second question, is there anything in any definition of mental health in statute?
Is that a rhetorical question?
Yeah, no, it's an actual question to Representative Holmes, perhaps, or anybody else who can answer it.
There must be.
Mr. Chairman, while she's consulting, we have a range of mental health descriptions, and I can't remember what the exact code is called, but we use them quite often when we're talking about giving mental health services.
EMS.
Right.
Ratings or whatever.
And, so my guess is it would fall into that code, which is very broad.
Representative Holmes?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I don't have an answer to the complete question, but I can tell you where the language came from. It comes from apparently statutes out of Colorado and Delaware, which is where we didn't want to make up new. We know this is a heavily litigated and very complex area, so we did not want to simply make something up on the fly. So we did look around to find statutes that had been in place in other states, and apparently that's where this language was taken from.
Thank you.
Thank you. Are there other Representative Dahlstrom?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You know, I really enjoy this committee, and as you stated, what I really respect the way everyone on this committee deals with each other's differences, and we're all a product of our background and all the things that have happened to us and what our values are, and sometimes it's hard when it's a real tough subject to respect the other person's difference. But, you know, in this instance, for me personally, if a child is of the physical size in the womb that a partial birth abortion would need to be performed, it would be possible to perform a cesarean section, and the baby could be delivered that way. And there have been babies that were a pound who have, yes, they've incurred tremendous medical costs, and yes, you know, they're called miracle babies because they truly are, but they have lived and they've become very productive citizens. And I think if there's something happening with the mother's health, I mean, maybe there's been a car accident or something, and it's necessary to perform a cesarean section and go that route, I think that's a way to go. If there's something happening with the mother's, you know, mental health, again, I think that would be the way to go, and then give the baby up for adoption. There are so many people that want those children and either physically can't have them or made decisions years before about their own reproductive you know, choices in their body that they regret, and I'm making my comments based on conversations that I've had with people. I'm not just, you know, pulling stuff out of the air or from stories I've read. These are from real life conversations. I believe that those babies would be warmly welcomed in people's homes. And I just, you know, for a baby, you know, it's been stated, the pictures I think would be disturbing to all of us in this committee. We deal with things that are not often pleasant, but if you have to go through the things that are necessary to, you know, take instruments and crush bones and things and remove a child, then I believe that that child can live in the incubator and that there's another route that we can take. And so because of that, I'm going to oppose this amendment.
Representative Holmes?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Unfortunately, I'm not a doctor, so there's I can't give any particular medical insights as to anything on my own, but what I can point to is that this same debate that we're having, whether or not there needs to be a health of the mother exception in a statute like this, has been the subject of at least two U.S. Supreme Court decisions. In one event, they found on one side, and on the other, they found on the other side. The debate seems to be about the testimony that was given on the record in these cases about whether or not this procedure was ever required to protect the health of the mother. In both cases, the statute contained a life of the mother exception, as does the one in front of us. In both cases, there was a lot of debate in the medical arena. It was not 100% on either side. There was a serious debate and a serious division between the medical professionals on both sides of the debate as to whether or not this procedure was ever medically necessary to save and protect the health of the mother. And in the one case, the testimony was more on one side, and in the other, it was divided enough that they decided that they would err. In the second Supreme Court case, they would err on going with the statute and upholding the statute as written, giving deference. But the debate's there. The debate's very much alive in the medical community as to whether or not this procedure is ever actually medically necessary to preserve the health of the mother. And because that debate is there, it's entirely possible the U.S. Supreme Court, maybe the Alaska Supreme Court, would back us up if we pass the statute as is without the health of the mother. But is that the right decision? With that decision out there, with that debate out there about whether or not this procedure is ever going to be medically necessary to preserve the health of the mother, because that debate is so active, I have to come down on the side of allowing a health exception. I would hate to be the reason passing a bill out that does not have a health of the mother exception and have it be that somebody is crippled for life, I can't even come up with what it would be. I mean, the words are in there, substantial risk of permanent injury. We're not talking, I did not draft this to be just a really light standard. I intentionally put it in to be a real standard. I would never forgive myself if a mother with five kids while pregnant with the sixth, if something happened and this was medically necessary to preserve her health, and we'd made it illegal, not only illegal, a Class C felony for this to be performed, and it was medically necessary to preserve her health, and she couldn't care for her five existing children. These are the things that I think about, and that is why I'm putting forth this amendment. Because that debate is out there in the medical community, I feel it's important that we put that in there and allow that exception.
Representative Foster.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And again, I respect your opinion. I respect you, and you and I have had a lot of discussions on a lot of things. So, you know, even going through a normal, if there is such a thing as a normal childbirth, every woman has a different story. Every father has a different version of their pregnancy. There are things that can happen. I should have paid better attention in science class. I mean, things that can happen that can be fixed. A bladder gets damaged. Something happens in a urinary tract or in a vaginal tract or something like that, and a doctor may or may not be able to go back and fix it. And it's a risk I know that I, as a woman, knew that I was taking when I chose to give birth. I know people who have the three or four or five children already, as you stated, and then they find themselves pregnant again. And I don't know why I know so many of these people, but, you know, I know of one situation where the mother chose to give birth and gave the baby up for adoption because she couldn't, she felt she couldn't care for those four or five children she had and one more. And I believe she made the right decision for herself, one that she can live with, and for that child. I've also worked with other, I say parents, because I've had men come into my office and say that the mother of their child chose to have an abortion at whatever stage along the line, and it's something that they've carried around for their whole life, and feel that they can't forgive themselves for, because for whatever reason they weren't able to convince the mother that they would take the child, they would take full responsibility, they would step up to the plate, you know, whatever it took. I think kind of what I'm getting at is there's no 100% sure answers, but the example that you gave of the mom with the five kids, I truly think that she would choose to give that baby up for adoption, that she wouldn't want it terminated, that she would want to deliver that baby C-section and give it an opportunity to live and let it be adopted into another home. That's my belief. And I think that, and again, based on the experiences that I've had with women who have been in my office and been in my home and have called in the middle of the night and said, I need to talk to you about the situation that happened, and now I can't go back and change it. I know that has a lifelong effect on them. And I have a little bit of personal experience with it. My own mother was pregnant in 1964 when the rubella epidemic was going around the United States. And the doctors advised her to have an abortion, and my brother was born, and he does have a hearing problem, but he was not the monster that they said he was going to come out to be. And he was hospitalized for a month after a premature birth, but I do know as a family, and granted I was younger, but the family was involved in making that decision. And so I think I feel that I understand the intent of where you're coming with this. I genuinely feel that your heart's in the right place, but I also feel that there is an option for that particular mom, that example that you gave, to give that child up for adoption and then continue with her life. And if she can't take one more, and we all have different levels of what we can and can't deal with, and that's not for us to judge what people's levels are, you know, with that. If she can't, I believe there's parents, loving parents, that want those children.
Thank you. Representative Parker?
Yes, thank you. The section that you are making the amendment in here talks about the life of the mother and protecting the life of the mother. So don't go out of your thinking that we don't regard the life of the mother. In fact, because of the nature of this debate, both in the Supreme Court and state by state, the life of the mother has been given the first place with regard to these two lives. If there's no other way to deliver that baby without causing the death of that mother, then the mother gets the preference, and that's what we put in statute. I got to tell you, just historically, it probably has been the other way around, where if you come upon a situation where a woman's life was in danger, historically in various different societies, they would try to save that baby, and because that is the progeny of their generation. So historically, up until the Roe v. Wade in America, even up until that point, that was the case. So we value the fruit of the womb that highly. So we have been pushed, I think, into the situation where we have to debate that triage situation. And so in statute, we have said the life of that mother has that value. But I think it's also important for us to say that that young life has that value, too. And so we these odd circumstances put upon us statutorily where we can only, those of us who disagree with the Supreme Court on the Roe versus Wade, for example, can only push where it's possible for us. And this is one place where it is so obvious that that life is a young child that we are going to statutorily say, thou shalt not. But because there are, beyond partial birth abortion, life and health issues in the Hyde Amendment and various different places that the Supreme Court will not let us travel. But in this particular area, they have, in fact, I think, satisfied my understanding. They know exactly what they're doing. They know that's a life in that womb. But it becomes so egregious at the abortion, in a partial birth abortion, that they cannot deny it. But they will deny it at 10 weeks or 12 weeks. And so you can see my position. My position is that's a life, whether it starts from conception to this delivery. But because of the nature of law we're in, this is the best that I can do. And so I'm going to speak against the amendment just for that very reason.
Representative Holmes, I'm going to maintain my objection. Do you have final remarks? Do you want us to vote on this amendment? What are your wishes as the maker of amendment number one?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm not going to withdraw the amendment. I would like to call for a vote on it. It probably doesn't surprise many of you. In contrast to my colleague, Representative Coghill, I would just say that just because the Supreme Court has said we can doesn't mean we should. I would put a very high value on the life and health of the mother, and I do understand there is a life exception in there anyway. I don't want to be at all misleading. I understand that's in there already, but I think that the health of the mother exception is important enough that just because with the debate out there as to whether this procedure is necessary in certain circumstances, I think it's very, very important that we have a health of the mother. I think that the health of the life and health of the mother is extremely important. And so I'm going to carry forth with my amendment.
Okay. I'll maintain my objection. Susan, if you'll call the roll.
Representative Lynn.
No.
Representative Holmes.
Yes.
Representative Gruenberg is not present. Representative Dahlstrom.
No.
Representative Coghill.
No.
Representative Samuels.
No.
Representative Rammers.
No.
One yes, five no.
All right. Are there any other amendments to House Bill 301? Okay, that brings it back to the committee. Is there any?
If I could, for the record, I'd just like to say that I appreciate Representative Holmes coming to me a half hour before the committee meeting and briefing me on her concerns and describing the amendment to me. That was very nice. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Feller. Representative Holmes, I'm new to judiciary also, but you have brought remarkable dynamic to this committee on many subjects, and one should never be discouraged from stretching and testing for tolerance. And in this case, I think we found out where it is. Is there any discussion on House Bill 301?
I'd like to make a comment when you're ready.
Representative Lane.
I suppose, Mr. Chair, that it's fair to disclose, and I hope it's no secret, that from the death of my being, I am pro-life. I believe in the protection of innocent human life from the moment of conception until natural death. Here, obviously, we're not debating personhood at the moment of conception or any other stage of the pregnancy. We're here today talking about infanticide. To me, as a baby is, for all practical purposes, already been born. And life is precious. My life, your life, everybody's life, everybody who's listening, our lives are precious. We need to protect life. And I support this amendment because it does just that. Not amendment, the bill.
Thank you, Representative Lynn. Any other remarks on House Bill 301? Representative Holman?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'll just say that I'm planning to object to the bill. I will reiterate that I just think that the health of a woman is tantamount. I think it's very important. I'm disappointed that that's not included in the bill, and so I will be objecting to passage of the bill, movement of the bill.
Thank you. Representative Dahlstrom?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to make a motion to move House Bill number 301, version C, with individual recommendation, and there is not an attached fiscal note, is there? No.
I don't believe there's a fiscal note.
No, we'll object.
All right, and Representative Holmes objects for the record. Susan, would you call the roll, please?
Representative Holmes?
No.
Representative Gruenberg is not present. Representative Dahlstrom?
Yes.
Representative Coghill?
Yes.
Representative Samuels?
Yes.
Representative Lynn?
Yes.
Representative Ramirez?
Yes.
5 yes, 1 no.
Thank you. So with that, House Bill 301 will move from the House Judiciary Committee. Thank you very much, Representative Keller. Nice to see you, Jim Pound. All right, and before we wind up our affairs for today, on Wednesday, we are, if anybody is familiar with the Delancey Street project in San Francisco, there is a program, the Mountain View Diner, and I have trouble pronouncing the name of the program in Anchorage. Does anybody know the name?
Channel Yet.
What did I say?
Channel Yet.
The Channel Yet program. We'll have a one-hour presentation on that to begin our meeting on Wednesday, and then we will proceed with a discussion on HJR 27, and then depending on the timeliness with which we are able to get some additional information on House Bill 255. If the committee sees fit, we may bring that back before us and figure out how to address those concerns. Are there any other remarks by members of the committee before we adjourn for the day?
The intention is to still go to 4 on Wednesday?
If necessary, I want to have the discretion to do that so that we can maintain the fresh productivity that the building seems to be yielding in this early session. All right, with no other remarks, it is 2:45, and we are adjourned.
You can